From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America is one nation under God, says the Pledge of Allegiance, and President Bush is all for that. He invokes the Almighty's name at every turn, invoked it last fall, all the way to victory. The politics of religion are playing a growing role in American public life. The religious right is singing hallelujah, but not evangelical Christian and social activist Jim Wallace. Wallace says he hardly recognizes the Jesus being invoked by political leaders these days. Now he's out to set the record straight tonight on Point, Christian activist Jim Wallace and God's politics. But first tonight, we begin in Washington, where Douglas Feith, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and a top policy advisor to Donald Rumsfeld, has announced he will leave his job at the Pentagon this summer. Feith, the son of a Holocaust survivor and civilian side powerhouse at the Pentagon, has been at the forefront of the so-called neoconservative school of Bush administration officials who pushed hard for war with Iraq. Joining me now is Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard Wolff, how are people interpreting Douglas Feith's announcement that he's going?
Well, people are really seeing it as the start of an expected clear-out at the Pentagon. As I'm sure you're well aware, really the highest-profile holdover of the first Bush administration inside the cabinet is, of course, Donald Rumsfeld, defense secretary. Doug Feith is one of his top officials. He's been a lightning rod for criticism. And the rumor mills about how long Rumsfeld himself will survive in his job are only spinning faster because of Doug Feith's forthcoming departure.
Douglas Feith says he's going to spend more time with his family. Who did Douglas Feith please in Washington and why? And who did he not please and why?
Well, I'd say the list of his enemies is longer than the list of his fans. The people he dismayed the most were the military leadership inside the Department of Defense, the foreign policy establishment inside Washington, and many people, even among the hawkish members of the Bush administration, who felt that he was pursuing his own agenda on Iraq. Of course, he's a star of the neoconservative firmament that seemed so powerful, at least in the aftermath of the immediate aftermath of the invasion of Iraq. But to him, he's a sort of crusader for the cause.
And the cause is, what was it that so offended the military brass and the foreign policy establishment? What was the so-called agenda you refer to of Douglas Feith?
Well, Doug Feith, you know, I interviewed Doug Feith in summer of 2000 before the war, and he was very much of the opinion that the war in Iraq would be a lot easier than people were expecting in terms of the quagmire that we were all writing about at the time. And he also believed that, in his own words, the road to Jerusalem ran through Baghdad.
Meaning?
Meaning that you could actually solve the Middle East conflicts of various causes, including proliferation, the Arab-Israeli conflict, by starting off with Iraq. It would lead to a sort of domino effect through the region. Now, of course, part of that thinking is still there, present in the president's own ideas about spreading democracy through the region. But he firmly believed that Iraq would be the start of great things to come across the region.
Is he eating crow these days? Is Iraq simmers in violence and American casualties go up or not?
Well, the sort of goalposts have moved in a sense. The neoconservative movement, people like Doug Feith, say that things are more difficult than they expected, but they're on the right path. The problem for Doug Feith in particular is that he was responsible for the post-war planning. And that's where the real tensions with the military leadership come in, because in their opinion, in many people's opinions in Washington, that was totally inadequate. And really, that was his area. And he especially ran into problems with State Department officials who encouraged him and the Department of Defense to take a very different route.
He was also at the center of the apparent effort to push the notion that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, to push that intelligence before the war.
Right. He was very deeply involved in that, very closely connected to Ahmed Chalabi, who was the Pentagon's favorite Iraqi exile, and has now fallen into disfavor. He was one of the first people, Doug Feith was one of the first people that Chalabi called when his offices were raided in Iraq. So he's very close to that. He also promoted the idea that Iraq was tied not just to weapons of mass destruction, but terrorism, and especially al-Qaeda.
That al-Qaeda, Saddam Hussein link that any number of reports have now discredited. He's said to have had the vice president's ear. Is he close to Dick Cheney?
It's not clear to me that he's personally close, but there are a number of officials that work for both the vice president and Doug Feist who are in very close contact with one another. In many ways, the vice president has an informal network of aides that are loosely associated with his own, who consider themselves part of the same group of hawks, whether they're working for people like John Bolton at the State Department, or Doug Feist in his office for the Secretary of Defense, and then the Vice President. So it's a sort of informal grouping. I'm not sure how close the top men are to each other, but certainly their own aides consider themselves part of the same group.
And Richard Wolff, we're getting kind of conflicting reports about whether the Bush administration sees its victory in November as an affirmation of the foreign policy, the neoconservative policy that it rolled out in its first term, that it's now going to sort of double up and go at that harder than ever, or is it backing away? How does this announcement of an impending resignation figure into that analysis?
Well, it's really the president's foreign policy, and he certainly sees the election as an affirmation of his approach. I mean, remember, the subjects of national security and defense were the highest ones throughout the whole campaign. There was certainly the toughest challenge John Kerry faced in terms of establishing his credentials. So the president certainly sees it as an affirmation of his policy, of what he likes to think of as a forward-leaning policy. Where there has been some confusion is the nature of the president's inaugural address, which seemed to expand his foreign policy vision even further, and elevating the promotion of democracy and ending tyranny to the highest possible level, a vital area of national interest. That's where the president himself has dialed back. But when it comes to Iraq and the approach in Iraq, certainly the White House thinks that the voters, the American people, are behind it.
Is there a sense in Washington that Douglas Feith pushed very hard to get America into this? The country's in kind of a mess now in Iraq. Now he walks away.
Well, there were a number of people who thought that he should have gone some time ago. He, among other things he was involved with was the treatment of detainees in Iraq and also at Guantanamo Bay. So he really has been at the center of many, many controversies, some of the most controversial policies both at home and abroad. I don't think the sense is, you know, how can he leave a sort of a sinking ship, but more like how did he survive so long when there were so many problematic areas of policy laid at his front doorstep.
Richard Wolff, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. He spoke with me from Washington. Progressive, evangelical, Christian activist Jim Wallace is not happy with the way religion is playing into American politics these days. The right, says Wallace, including President Bush, has hijacked the language of faith for its own political agenda to justify going to war in Iraq, to give tax cuts to the rich and more. The left, he says, the Democrats, are simply a no-show in a vital national conversation about religious values. This hour on Point, Christian activist Jim Wallace and God's politics. You can join the conversation. Do you want religion, and specifically Jesus, in the middle of American politics? Did the values freight train running through the presidential campaign capture your religious priorities? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Jim Wallace, faith-based Christian activist, preacher, and founder of a national network of progressive Christians called Sojourners. He's also the longtime editor of Sojourners magazine. His new book is entitled God's Politics: Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It, A New Vision for Faith and Politics in America. Jim Wallace, good evening. Welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. You're a preacher, and you've been preaching a lot on this subject lately with the book out. But take us to the heart of it. What's missing from the presentation of Christianity that we've seen surging into the middle of American politics?
Well, I, as you said, I'm an evangelical Christian, and when I hear talk of Jesus, sometimes he's portrayed as pro-rich, pro-war, and only pro-American. And I wonder what's happened. How did our faith get stolen? It's almost like we need a rescue operation here. I doubt if Jesus' first or top priorities would have been capital gains tax cuts for the wealthy and the occupation of Iraq. So how do we take back the faith? This book is really about how to take back the faith from what seems sometimes to be a hijacking. The truth is religion doesn't neatly fit political categories of left and right. It is best when it's not ideologically predictable or loyally partisan, but can cut both ways, left and right. So we need a better, deeper conversation. And the good news is I think that's beginning. I've been very encouraged by the discussion, the response to all of this so far. And I think it tells me that America is ready, finally ready, for a better discussion about the whole topic of faith, values, and politics.
What would a better discussion look like? What do you mean by a better discussion? The country seems so polarized, even I must say, among many Christians, never mind moving outside the faith.
Well, I get concerned when faith and values become used as wedges and weapons to divide us and even destroy us, and not bridges to bring us together across these, as you say, polarized, dividing lines. And I think we can do better. Neither party, I think, gets this right. The Republicans are very comfortable with the language of faith and religion and values. Sometimes I think they almost act like they own the topic or own the territory or sometimes, at worst, own God in politics. Yet they reduce it all. They reduce the moral values conversation, usually to two issues, abortion and gay marriage, which are, I think, very important questions that need a better moral conversation on all sides. We can talk about that if you'd like. But my goodness, are these the only two moral values, the only two religious concerns? I find 3,000 verses in the Bible about poor people, wealth and poverty, rich and poor, those who are left out, left behind. So fighting poverty, working to overcome poverty, clearly is a moral value, in fact, a biblical matter. Protecting the environment, God's creation, is a moral value. And whether we go to war, how we go to war, whether we tell the truth about going to war, these are all deeply religious, theological matters.
Here's a message from Bob Jones, the third president of Bob Jones University, to President Bush after his election in November. He said, "In your re-election, God has graciously granted America, though she doesn't deserve it, a reprieve from the agenda of paganism. Put your agenda on the front burner and let it boil. You owe the liberals nothing. They despise you because they despise your Christ." Is that a fellow Christian speaking to you, Jim Wallace?
Well, Bob Jones is in that sort of backwater of American fundamentalism. And people like Bob Jones claim to be evangelicals. They're really fundamentalists. They're sort of American fundamentalists whose religion is much more American than Christian, in my view. But what he does, he portrays Democrats, liberals, the left, as utterly secular. And this is interesting because the Democrats are often uncomfortable with the language of faith and values, and which is sad because a few decades ago, not very long ago, Democrats were vitally linked to a civil rights movement led by black churches. So how are they now so successfully portrayed as hostile to religion and secular? The media mythology, and Bob Jones is tying into this, is that, you know, all the religious folks are crammed into red states, and the blue states are full of agnostics. Now, of course, that isn't true. And Barack Obama at the Democratic National Convention, you remember that, in Boston, he proclaimed, "We have an awesome God in the blue states," he said. Now, the Democrats have to learn to recover their heart and their soul on this question, and I think recover a moral vocabulary that is consistent with the separation of church and state.
Jim Wallace, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about whose Christianity is driving American politics today. My guest, Jim Wallace, author of God's Politics. You can join the conversation. Does the right have it wrong? Is the left out to lunch on religion in public life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about whose Christianity is driving American politics today. My guest is Jim Wallis. His new book is God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? What were Jesus' politics? Are they the same as George Bush's? Should religion be part of American politics at all? And is there really common ground for right-wing Christians and left-wing Christians? And what about non-Christians? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. President Bush speaks about religion explicitly and implicitly very often. Here in the third presidential debate, he spoke about his religion.
I never want to impose my religion on anybody else. But when I make decisions, I stand on principle. And the principles are derived from who I am. I believe we ought to love our neighbor like we love ourselves. It's manifested in public policy through the faith-based initiative where we've unleashed the armies of compassion to help heal people who hurt. I believe that God wants everybody to be free. That's what I believe. And that's one of the part of my foreign policy.
President Bush in the third presidential debate, October 13th of last year. Jim Wallis, I wish you'd speak to President Bush's language and presentation of his faith for a moment. How do you read it? How do you see it? Right there is a lot from the Bible. Love your neighbor as yourself. Armies of compassion. Heal the people who are hurt. God wants everybody to be free. And that's just in, 10 seconds of a bit of debate.
President Bush has a very real personal faith. Some people doubt that. They think it's fraudulent or they're cynical. I've been in meetings with him a few times and even had some one-on-one conversation in the corners of rooms and meetings, and I think his faith is sincere. I don't quibble with that. He has a faith that has changed his life in some important ways, his personal life. My concerns about the president are with his theology. For example, a faith-based initiative can be a good thing. In the UK, the Blair government has a faith-based initiative. Clinton had faith-based initiatives in housing and HUD. Al Gore was for that. John Kerry said he was for that, too. But isolated faith-based initiatives focusing on voluntarism don't substitute for a serious plan to significantly reduce poverty, to help low-income families move out of poverty, to deal with 3 billion people in this world who live on less than $2 a day in a silent tsunami that kills 30,000 children each and every day because of hunger and disease related to hunger. It means moral will, political will, a societal commitment. In Britain, they're committed to cutting child poverty by half in 10 years. They're halfway there, and they're doing a good job. We met with the president in Austin, several of us. He called the meeting before he went to Washington for the first time. And we talked about faith-based initiatives and poverty, and there was a sincerity in him. In fact, at one point he said over in kind of a corner of the room, he said, "Jim, I don't understand poor people. I have never lived around poor people. I'm a white Republican guy who just doesn't get it. But I'd like to. How do I get it?"
Wait, who said this?
President Bush.
President Bush himself.
Okay. It was a very candid. Mm-hmm. I thought it was the kind of thing presidents don't normally say. But I admired the kind of honesty and candor. He was struggling with this question. And I said that he needed to listen to people who are poor themselves or those who live alongside people who are low income. And in his inaugural address, he said that. He said, "Most of us don't understand poverty. So let us listen to those who do." So I thought, perhaps this president was going to listen and pay attention. And I think he at that level did care. But the thing is, the resources never came through. The budgets are moral documents, you see. They reveal the priorities of a nation or a city or a family. And this budget doesn't prioritize families who are poor. 9 million families in this country are working hard full-time and are falling short, not getting by.
You call many of the women their Burger King moms.
Burger King mom. She's the one who we saw one day at the local Burger King, the drive-in window, and she's running back and forth to a table where there are three kids, and We finally figured out she's helping her kids with her homework at 4 in the afternoon.
While she's working at Burger King.
Orders at the Burger King, that's right.
Jim Wallace,
so soccer mom's important, you know, and security mom and NASCAR dad, but what about Burger King mom? So I think the president has a God of charity. I think that's sincere. But the Bible really talks about a God of justice that talks about, you know, structures and policies and resources and behaviors. And so I was hoping he'd move from kind of the self-help Methodism that he embraces to a kind of a social reform Methodism after the founder of Methodism, John Wesley, who in Britain fought against slavery. He was an abolitionist. He fought for child labor law reform, for women's suffrage. I mean, this is a kind of a, does religion just sort of take care of people who are poor, or does it transform the way we do things so that we remove people from poverty?
Let me give you an interpretation. This is just personal. I don't know if it's it's right or wrong. But I hear this kind of message from Christian voices, and not only Christian voices, on the liberal end of the spectrum. On the more conservative end, I hear people saying, you know what, if you don't have your core values right, no amount of social structure or programs is going to get this society in order, is going to cure poverty. Do we have a kind of Old Testament, New Testament tension here? What do you hear in the conservative analysis of poverty and how to approach it?
Well, I have a chapter in the book that talks about how the poor are trapped in the debate about poverty. Because conservatives come up to me and say, you know, unless we talk about personal responsibility and rebuilding family life and making better choices, we're never going to overcome poverty. Then liberals come up and say, unless we invest in child care and housing, affordable housing and decent health care, we're never going to overcome this problem. And I listen to them and I think, well, neither must live anywhere near around poor people, because clearly there are choices, there are behavioral choices, there are family circumstances, there are cultural factors that cause or further entrench poverty, and there are policies, there are choices, there are lack of living incomes, lack of living family incomes among poor families. You know, in Denver, you have to work 120 hours a week right now at minimum wage to afford any kind of housing. 55 million Americans haven't got any health care. Churches, congregations, synagogues can't provide that. So I'm suggesting in this book that we stop blaming each other, liberal, conservative, blaming back and forth, and be disciplined by outcomes. How do we actually help low-income families to succeed?
But that
and
requires
that
putting
a combination of personal and social responsibility.
And requires putting addressing poverty above all else. Is that really going to happen? You're opposed to abortion. You're opposed to gay marriage. So are many conservative Christians. On the Democratic Party, the sort of liberal wing of American politics, choice around abortion and choice in gay marriage or the availability of gay marriage are seen as very important issues. Do you really believe that Christians are sort of part this, get across this divide, or are they just permanently encamped on either side, not willing, even for the sake of addressing poverty, to get past those things?
Well, that actually doesn't represent my views on those two very tough questions.
Oh, excuse me. Please give it to us.
I think those are very important questions, and I think we really can find some important new common ground, despite the sort of, as you say, the polarizing, politicizing of them both. For example,
do you support gay marriage? Do you support abortion?
Okay, let's take them one at a time.
Okay.
On abortion, I think pro-life and pro-choice people really must come together to really attack, significantly reduce this abortion rate, unwanted pregnancies. Nobody wants that. If we really focus on teenage pregnancy, adoption reform, supporting low-income women economically, that significantly will reduce the abortion rate.
And what about those abortions that don't go away, that women still want in spite of those efforts? Would you favor them or not?
My own view is that criminalizing women making very agonizing, often desperate choices isn't the best way forward, isn't even really the best way to be pro-life. Mm. The Democrats themselves say abortion should be safe, legal, and rare, and then spend much more time on just keeping it legal and not talking about making it rare. Ted Kennedy, a couple of weeks ago began to talk about he supports the legal option for abortion, but then he said, we've got to really work at making this rare. Senator Clinton, just a couple of days ago, said
Hillary Clinton,
this is a tragic choice. It's never a happy choice. Can't we work hard to make that choice less and less necessary?
And gay marriage?
Here is some here is some common ground, I think, that a lot of pro-life and pro-choice people could find some real solutions around. On the gay marriage question, it was very sad to see how gay marriage became, in this election, a kind of surrogate for being concerned about family. If you're concerned about family, you oppose gay marriage. That's the wrong way to be concerned about family, in my view. For example, when I travel the country and talk about the real issues about families, I say parenting has become a countercultural activity in America. All parents' heads, liberal or conservative, begin to nod. I'm a father of a six-year-old and a two-year-old, two boys, and anybody trying to raise kids in this culture, the kind of values coming at kids, the kind of cultural pollution that's out there in the marketplace, it's tough. How do you support parents raising kids, the most important job in the society? How do we support marriage and family in real, practical ways? And then, in a democratic, pluralistic society, how do we offer what I think is the right and good thing, some kind of legal protection for same-sex couples? And after the election, they did exit polls, and they found something like 25% of us supported gay civil marriage, 35% of us supported civil unions. That's a majority of people who favor some kind of legal protection for same-sex couples.
So you would say no to gay marriage, but yes to some kind of legal protection?
Well, you see, what I'm trying to do is find where the common ground is, and what I'm saying is I think most of us, I think, would support legal protection for same-sex couples. And the states are going to wrestle with whether you call it gay civil marriage or civil unions. And what I am saying, and particularly to conservatives on this, is whether the gay couple living down the street who've been together for a long time in a very faithful, committed relationship, whether the sort of certificate on the wall says civil union or gay civil marriage is probably not going to cause the other families on the block to unravel. Families are unraveling because of other things, because of financial pressures, because of infidelity, because of soaring divorce rates, because of what I finally got focus on the family. You know who they are in Colorado Springs.
Mr. Dobson.
Mr. Dobson and his people. After an hour and a half debate with his top policy people, they finally conceded to me. They said, okay, Jim, we admit family breakdown is due much more to heterosexual dysfunction than to gays and lesbians. But, they said, we can't speak for our fundraising department, which is the point, you see. So this kind of pitch battle back and forth, left and right, doesn't get to where we want to go. How do we really work hard to prevent unwanted pregnancies? How do we work together real hard to support families and parents and parenting especially, and then give same-sex couples the legal protection that they are entitled to in a democratic and pluralistic society? And those issues, I think that would diffuse those issues significantly as the political hot button single voting issues. And then we could get to what I think are the much bigger issues.
So there you are touching on the social issues there, on poverty. You've got another big section of your book that asks, when did Jesus become pro-war? How do you see Jesus as being presented in our time as pro-war?
Well, the religious right, to be honest, doesn't talk much about Jesus. They talk about their faith, and they are clearly pro-war. Their faith is solely pro-American. The truth is that most every major religious body, church bodies in the world, except the American Southern Baptists, said the war in Iraq was wrong. It was not a just war. The Pope is hardly a liberal religious leader. And the Pope opposed the war in Iraq. So President Bush defied the Pope on Iraq, one could say. And around the world, and I'm talking about evangelicals and Pentecostals around the world, were opposed to the war in Iraq. This war was conceived in confusion, carried out in arrogance, and has resulted in chaos. It has not made my two kids 20 blocks from the White House more secure or more safe. it makes them far less safe.
I don't want to commingle necessarily this war and 9/11, but you have a portion here called A Moral Response to Terrorism.
Right.
From your Christian perspective, what is a moral response to terrorism?
Well, I spend a couple chapters on that, so it's hard to summarize in a paragraph, but it says that we can't become people that we're not and don't want to be in our battle with terrorism. Sometimes there are real dangers out there. I think you've got to be prudent and strategic in response to those dangers. But a politics of fear will cause us to do things that we don't want to do or ignore things we don't want to look the other way from Abu Ghraib, from the suspension of civil liberties, from spending all of our resources on war and weapons of war at the expense of everything else.
There's the negative side, but what is the positive moral response to terrorism?
Finally, I think we've got to deal with more than just, you know, that the debates had the president saying, I'll respond to terrorism by killing the terrorists. And John Kerry said, and I'll kill more terrorists. Now, that's hardly a good debate about how to succeed against terrorism. Now I think I use a phrase in the book that we have to drain the swamp of injustice in which the mosquitoes of terrorism breed, or we'll never defeat terrorism. There are resentments, there are angers, there are policies, there are grievances that are fueling the murderous and ugly and hideous agenda of these terrorists. And I want to take away their argument. I want to dry up that swamp. And then I think we have to deal with them very clearly and firmly in terms of finding and bringing to justice those who are responsible. But I don't think in Iraq now we've seen tens of thousands of civilian casualties. Now, those people had nothing to do with the attacks on September 11th, and they have suffered the consequences, as have our young American men and serve as women over there. And so we are not dealing with the root causes here.
George Bush was reelected in November. What does that say, Jim Wallace, the president's reelection then, about America, in your view, as a Christian majority country?
Well, I think in this election, terrorism was a fundamental issue. I also think leadership was a critical issue. The president was perceived as a strong leader, a clear leader. You know where I stand, he said, and we did. That wasn't always true of his opponent. And I think this moral values question became a big issue for lots of voters. A reporter called me the next day and said, well, I guess your vision lost. And I said, mine wasn't running. Mine wasn't running in this election. Nobody championed poverty as a moral issue. No one made Iraq a fundamental moral and theological issue in this campaign. It should have been done. It wasn't done.
We'll come back and hear much more about that. Plus, here from our callers, many are waiting to talk to Jim Wallace, author of the new book, God's Politics. You can join the conversation. Non-Christians, how does it feel to hear the country's politics summed up through the lens of Jesus Christ? And is Jim Wallace singing your song tonight, or singing from a different songbook? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about whose Christianity is driving American politics, American policy today. My guest is Jim Wallace. His new book is God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. Tom's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Tom, thank you very much for taking my call. I want to say how thrilled I am to hear your guests' opinions, because they mirror the opinions that I learned as a child. I grew up Roman Catholic in Massachusetts and essentially a liberal, you know, New Deal family. And when the discussions of religion in our political system go on, I don't recognize the Christianity that I grew up with. The Christianity that I grew up with as a Roman Catholic, dealing with the Sermon on the Mount, you know, are that Jesus's admonition that we should love one another as I have loved you. All of that formed the basis of social justice, which I always thought was the foundation of my liberal democratic politics. So when I hear the right wing saying that liberal Democrats don't get it, or that they don't have a Christian point of view, I don't know who they're talking about.
So who's carrying the torch for you today, Tom?
Well, I can't say say that any Democratic politician that I've heard recently carries the torch for me. You know, I could say that, you know, that Ted Kennedy carries the torch for me because he carries the torch for a liberal Democratic position that has a foundation in Christian morality.
And he is senator of the bluest of blue states, not the winning team in November's election.
Well, I know it's not the winning team in November's election, and yet when I hear your guest describe, you know, draining the swamp of social injustice, I mean, you can hear echoes of Martin Luther King. You can hear echoes of JFK's inaugural speech that God's work, God's work on earth is truly our own work.
Not to mention Jesus, as you say. Tom, thanks for your call. Jim Wallace, you must hear this a lot. This is someone who does sing from your hymn book, and yet he says there's no torchbearer for him. You say that in the elections, in the campaign season, nobody was showing up to represent your view, maybe our caller Tom's view. The title of your book says the left doesn't get it. What is it that the left doesn't get?
Well, let me tell Tom an encouraging story. I was on the Jon Stewart, The Daily Show, the other night. You know, this great show where all of the, I think most,
sure, Comedy Central,
most young people in America under 30 get their more news from him than from the networks. And he had me on the show. And we talked about these questions. And I raised, you know, this problem of how Jesus probably wouldn't have had his first priorities, capital gains, tax cuts, and the occupation of Iraq. And this progressive, youthful audience began to hoop and holler for progressive religion. Since then, I've gotten hundreds of emails from young people who said one of these two things. I lost my faith because of the religious right, because of Bush, because of Falwell. For the first time, after watching the show last night, I think maybe I could have faith again. Or I didn't know, many said, that you could be a Christian or a person of faith and care about poverty, the environment, or the war in Iraq.
That sounds like an electorate in waiting, but you say the Democrats don't get it. What is it they don't get?
Well, the cultural archetype that we're now just, I think, changing is to be religious is to be right-wing. And the Democrats have played into that by being so uncomfortable. Where would we be, I ask the Democrats, if the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had kept his faith to himself? I believe in the separation of church and state. I really do. But the separation of church and state does not mean the segregation of moral values and religious language from public life. And the Democrats need to reframe their policy issues in a values context, talk about values. I don't think, we're not talking here, Tom, about religiosity in the center of politics. I don't think Jews should vote for Jews, Baptists for Baptists, or we should vote for the candidate who's praised the most or has learned the most Bible verses or any thing like that. We want our politics to have a moral compass, and that means all of us have a stake in this, not just Christians or Jews, not just religious people. I say again and again, religion does not have a monopoly on morality.
Jim, let me get to another caller. So many have been waiting. Yeah. Wally's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Wally. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
This is the first time, and I'm overwhelmed here. First, I want to say to Tom, who just called in.
Yes, sir.
Being a Catholic, most of us who are Pentecostal evangelical don't even think you will make it to heaven. And George Bush doesn't say that. I grew up for 25 years with a Pentecostal evangelical background. I actually went to Central Bible College in Springfield, Missouri, and Ashcroft was one of the people who came and spoke to our class.
So, and what's the message you want to bring us here, Wally?
The message is that, you know, they're hiding their basic story. If you ask them, I'm Catholic and this is what I believe, and you ask them, am I still religious enough? And they have to tell you, no, you're not if you're not born again.
You won't be saved. You're not on your way to heaven. Jim Wallace, you're an evangelical. Is this your interpretation of what it means to be an evangelical Christian?
Of course not. To be evangelical means to take Jesus seriously and to root your faith in the Bible. The 19th century evangelicals were abolitionists. They fought for child labor laws and women's suffrage. They put revival and reform together. The 20th century, we had a privatizing of faith. That was a heresy, really. It's a betrayal of faith. Now we're getting back to the kind of faith that lives its life out in the world. And so again, I want to say that a lot of people in America don't know that a progressive faith option exists.
But you know what Wally's talking about?
It's not such good news.
It's not hard to find Wally's definition being propagated in this country.
Sure, but what I'm saying is I'm not sure if Wally believes that or he's talking about what he thinks other people believe. But, you know, Sojourner's Magazine is equal parts evangelical, Catholic, Black Church, mainline Protestant. You know, Jews read the magazine, too, even though it's a Christian magazine. People who aren't Christian or Jewish are part of this. This has got to be a new conversation. Dr. King talked about this in a way that made all of us feel included, Christians and Jews, and agnostics will tell you that those nights in the church before the march in the street to confront the dogs and the clubs and the police were the spiritual high point of their lives. That's the way we can talk about this again. The sectarian religion, the America First religion, the my nation right or wrong, other people are going to hell. Sure, that's there. I'm saying there's a progressive religious option in America that a whole new generation is hungry for, and I'm finding this on this book tour. People that never, ever thought that you could be a person of faith with a social conscience are finding hope again that that's possible.
Jim Wallace, we've just got a few seconds left. Give us one bit of scripture to go out on tonight. Preacher man, what's the core? What's the heart?
You know, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen from the book of Hebrews. And my paraphrase is this: hope is believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change.
With that, we're out of time. Jim Wallace, author of God's Politics, editor of Sojourner Magazine, thank you for being with us tonight.
Great to be here. Thank you.
For listeners in the Boston area, Jim Wallace will be speaking at Trinity Church in Copley Square this Sunday at 4 p.m. In a moment, Senator Ted Kennedy calls for the U.S. military to pull out of Iraq. This is On Point. Today, Edward Kennedy became the first U.S. senator to call for a rapid end to the U.S. military presence in Iraq. He called for the nearly immediate withdrawal of 12,000 U.S. troops with a complete pullout by 2006. He called for the United Nations to assume oversight of creating a new Iraqi government and constitution. In his speech at Johns Hopkins University, the Massachusetts senator labeled the U.S. presence in Iraq an occupation and drew parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. The U.S. military presence has become part of the problem, not part of the solution, Kennedy said. We need a new plan that sets fair and realistic goals for self-government in Iraq and works with the Iraqi government on a specific timetable for the honorable homecoming of our forces. After the speech, I spoke with Senator Kennedy. I asked him why he was making his call for withdrawal.
This administration believes that our military is over there as part of the solution. I think the Iraqis perceived America's presence there as being part of an occupation. And I don't think that we are ever going to get a handle on the expansion of violence and the support for the insurgency as long as that condition remains. What we have to do is free ourselves, change our policy, and convince the Iraqi people that they have to have a responsibility for their political development and have to have a responsibility for their own security. They have to be as willing to die for their country as the American servicemen have been willing to die over the past 2 years.
President Bush said yesterday that the United States should remain in Iraq until the new government can defend itself. Do you agree?
Well, I think we ought to set a time, and a definite time. Otherwise, this is a never-ending commitment. This administration believes that this can be resolved. The battle for the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people can be won militarily. I think we've learned that lesson. We learned it in Vietnam. The French learned it in Algeria. The British learned it in Northern Ireland. I think we've seen that in Chechnya as well. There isn't going to be a military solution to the political problem. The Iraqis have to understand that they have to take full responsibility in the politics, and we have to announce a time definite for the withdrawal of American troops so that they will take the responsibility in developing their own militia. We will have a responsibility to help train that militia, and I think we can negotiate that over the next several months, but there ought to be a very clear idea that by the end of 2006, hopefully before that, American troops will be out.
All U.S. troops out by the end of 2006.
Exactly. We have to make sure the Iraqi forces want to defend and protect their country. They don't now because they don't believe that they own it. They think the United States is there for oil. They think we're over there because we want to have a power base in the Middle East. And we are losing the battle for the hearts and the minds of the people. Just as we thought we had a military solution in Vietnam, we think we've got a military solution here, and it's wrong.
Ted Kennedy, what's to keep Iraq from turning into a global terrorist haven? Already plenty of insurgents running around. If U.S. troops leave, what's to keep it from being the center of a real meltdown, of a regional meltdown that subsumes all the Middle East?
Well, first of all, the best way to have an independent Iraq is have Iraqis want to defend it. At the present time, that's not the case. Iraq was not the hotbed in part of the world on terror when we invaded it. That's all been demonstrated, that they did not have weapons of mass destruction and they were not part of the al-Qaeda. Every day that the Iraqis perceive us as to be occupiers, the insurgency and the anti-Americanism grows. That is happening every single day. The way to deal with this is to let the elections move ahead, let the Iraqis develop their constitution with the help of others besides the United States, the international community, and let them know before 2006 that they are going to have to inspire, train, and win the hearts and minds of the people and the military so that they will defend themselves.
Senator Kennedy, you did not support this war. You called it a fraud made up in Texas. You've called it George Bush's Vietnam. A Republican spokesman said today, it's remarkable that Senator Kennedy would deliver such an overtly pessimistic message only days before the Iraqi election. He said that you're not on board with President Bush's vision of spreading freedom around the world. What about that big project of centuries the president was talking about yesterday?
Well, first of all, that press release was issued before I even gave the speech, number one. Secondly, anyone who read the speech wouldn't be able to make that kind of a statement, number two. And third, we're hearing from those that are a strong supporter for the continuation of a military solution in Iraq. They support military resolution and solution. My perception is that Americans are perceived as occupiers, not liberators, any longer, and that the longer we stay there, longer we're involved, the insurgency is going to grow and expand, and it'll become more of a breeding ground for terror than if we follow the alternative policy that I've recommended.
And it took nearly a decade of debate and turmoil for the United States to pull out of Vietnam. The president says he's set on staying in Iraq as long as necessary. You're the first senator to call for an immediate withdrawal. How do you read the political landscape of this country, of Congress? Do you see the political climate changing on Capitol Hill against the war?
I think people have been ahead of the politicians on this issue, as they are in so many others, particularly now that they understand there were no weapons of mass destruction. There were no operational ties with al-Qaeda. That was the 9/11 commission. There was no vital, imminent threat to our national security as represented by the administration, and this administration has committed blunder after blunder over there, and the question is, how long are we going to let them do it, or are we going to have a change policy that offers it isn't a guarantee, and there may be losses as a result of this policy, but what is guaranteed, if we continue to have a military occupation, that we're going to see continued rise of insurgency, the continued loss of American lives, and the continued expenditures of billions and billions of taxpayers' dollars. That is not a good alternative. I think I offer a better and more hopeful one.
Senator Kennedy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.